Chapter 1. If Dorothy Kilgallen had not been so enthralled with Lee Harvey Oswald's assassin, roly-poly 53-year-old Jacob Rubenstein, also known as Jack Ruby, the first time she laid eyes on him from up close, she may have lived a long and fruitful life. However, enthralled Kilgallen was, and it was just days after that first encounter when Ruby shared secret information during his trial with her and only her about the assassination of Kilgallen's close friend, President John F. Kennedy. Whatever Ruby told Kilgallen in private interviews sealed her fate, starting the clock ticking toward her puzzling death less than 2 years later. Without question, Kilgallen and Ruby were a toxic mix, each destined to be victims of their respective roles in the JFK assassination, each denied justice. On February 20th, 1964, an especially warm day in Dallas, the feisty reporter had the initial brush with the quick-tempered mafia wannabe and Dallas strip club owner. Ruby's trial was held at the Dallas County Courthouse, the 8-story building built in 1913 by architect H.A. Overbeck in the classic neo-colonial architectural style. Featured marble staircasing through the entrance at the corners of Houston and Main Streets in downtown Dallas. From her front row seat at the so-called Trial of the Century, in a courthouse just a stone's throw from Dealey Plaza, Kilgallen watched Ruby from less than 20 feet away as the sullen, accused, cold-blooded murderer of Lee Harvey Oswald was led to the defense counsel table under heavy guard. Preliminary matters had to be concluded in the musty courtroom, complete with ceiling fans, before evidence could be presented on March 4th. Standing beside Ruby, his face reflecting the seriousness of the proceedings, were his two main attorneys, 57-year-old San Francisco-based Melvin Belli, a chunk of a man with spirited wavy hair and a loud baritone voice, and 51-year-old Jasper, Texas lawyer Joe Tonahill, a former wrestler who stood 6'4" and weighed more than 300 pounds. As the court proceedings continued, Kilgallen, dubbed by a fellow New York Journal-American reporter as open-minded, accessible, and fearless, posted a bevy of notes in a file she kept close at hand, sharing it with no one. By the end of the day, these notes became the foundation for an article she typed on her trusty Underwood typewriter in a quiet, overheated room at the Statler Hilton, the same hotel housing Belli. The article was then forwarded to the offices of the New York Journal-American, where her prolific words would splash across the front pages of newspapers throughout the country the next day through the vaunted Hearst Syndicate. As always, Kilgallen demonstrated her unmatched skills as a wordsmith. The Carl Sandburgs of the future will spend whole lifetimes trying to analyze the drama of this week and this scene. They will never be able to appreciate the unparalleled irony that exists today in this proud and gracious city. When it all boils down, after the assassination of a president, the slaying of a policeman, and the killing of a man nobody really knew, is little Jack Ruby. The hustler in the black suit and the very white shirt, neat and nervous, is the star of the show at last. If he died tomorrow, and he won't, he would die happy in the knowledge that he had made the big time. All the sweating that is being done in the apple green courtroom, with the lazy apple-green ceiling fans, is being done over him. The long, crowded row of brilliant, persuasive, charming, deceptive, tough, and realistic lawyers is split down the middle over Jack Ruby's fate. As Kilgallen watched, Judge Joe Brown Jr., his hazel eyes hidden behind black horn-rimmed glasses, had apparently caught her attention. She added, "The judge takes off his glasses and mops his brow with the powder-blue handkerchief after a difficult legal decision. The long, wooden church pews are filled with hot and restless reporters, straining to catch every word from a prospective juror that might affect Jack Ruby favorably or adversely." Describing the scene with dramatics in a manner only Kilgallen could have imagined, she provided a visual, propelling readers directly into the courtroom. The corridors of the courthouse are clogged with guards, television cameras, deputies, newspaper photographers, sheriffs, bailiffs, foreign correspondents, visiting lawyers, judges from other floors, well-dressed, soft-voiced ladies who haven't enough pull to get into the courtroom but are content to sit on benches or lean on walls outside and watch the action. Continuing, Kilgallen wrote, "The action revolves around Ruby. Ruby, the strip club owner. Ruby, the natty, runty booze seller who scared the unfortunate girl dancers who peeled for his customers, but could be charming and jovial when a cop came into the place," before adding, "His own lawyers, a formidable battery headed by Melvin Belly, a genius in any courtroom, have documented more than 100 incidences in which he demonstrated erratic and frightening behavior long before November 24, 1963. The day on which he strode past television cameras to kill Lee Harvey Oswald and give birth to more confusion and shame and mystery than any other man has ever created with a single bullet." Edging into Ruby's mental state, the critical aspect of the trial Kilgallen was most curious about, she observed, "Perhaps Jack Ruby's brain is damaged, as his defense claims. Perhaps he killed Oswald during a period of episodic dysfunction, as his lawyers will tell the eventual inevitable jury. Perhaps all killers are in a rage state, another predictable defense term, when they pull the trigger or stab the heart. But in court, Ruby is functioning pretty well. He is zingy, a Texas term for jittery, and inclined to worry over small problems far removed from the main peril, which is the death penalty." Continuing to focus on Ruby, whom Kilgallen believed was the real key to solving the JFK assassination, the greatest murder mystery in history, she observed, "Yet, little more than an hour later, the defendant bounced back quietly into the courtroom, lightly, like a dancer under clumsy guard. I was standing by the bar railing as he turned to take his seat, and he broke into a quick smile, gave me a friendly, bird-like nod, and said hello, brightly. Then everything quieted down, and as Judge Joe B. Brown returned to the bench, Jack Ruby became just a head in the crowd up front, a bald pate shadowed by a few penstrokes of black hair." Kilgallen's final thoughts were most revealing, providing insight into why she knew the Ruby trial would be a turning point in American history. She informed readers, "It was sickening that the trial was taking place because of a visit to Dallas by a tall and brilliant and graceful young man named John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And now John Kennedy is dead. And all that is left to Dallas and to history is Jack Ruby." The ace journalist and investigative reporter had titled the column, "Ruby Stars at Last." It was ignored, never published in any book about the assassinations until now. Unfortunate, since the article proved Kilgallen intended to provide the world with a first-hand account of the Jack Ruby trial, as only a reporter of her caliber could do. Yes, indeed. Ruby, ironically 52 years of age when he shot Oswald, the same age Kilgallen was when she died in 1965, was going to be the star. But now Kilgallen awaited the evidence, awaited hopefully the truth as to why he had killed Oswald, as well as why Oswald assassinated the president, if that really happened. Certainly many questions needed to be answered, and since Ruby was the center of attention, Kilgallen's plan was to try to convince Belly and Tannehill to permit her to interview Oswald's killer. Her editor at the New York Journal-American had told her that this was impossible. However, impossible wasn't a word a courageous journalist like Kilgallen would allow to get in the way of good, hard-nosed reporting, even if it was dangerous to do so. After all, Kilgallen, a college dropout who had overcome gender discrimination to become an unstoppable media icon with unlimited power at the top of her profession, believed she was invincible, that no one could harm her. Kilgallen knew that her reports from the Ruby trial and beyond might offend certain people, especially those attempting to cover up the truth about the tragic events in Dallas. She also knew she could make enemies during her probe of the assassinations, but none of them, she believed, would dare stop her from the responsibility to expose any wrongdoing, whether it was at the highest levels of government or with other sinister forces who assassinated her president. For Kilgallen, discovering the truth was personal, not business, based on her close friendship with JFK. Had Kilgallen, as her trusted allies Mark Sinclair and James Clement would later warn her during the days leading up to November 8, 1965, underestimated these enemies? Had she miscalculated the danger she faced? The risk she was taking by searching for the truth? 18 months following the Ruby trial, answers would surface, triggering not one, not two, not three, but four instances where governmental abuse of power resulted in a series of cover-ups unprecedented in American history. When each occurred, there appeared to be one goal above all others, discrediting Kilgallen. Based on her body of work, she was the most credible reporter to have ever investigated the JFK and Oswald assassinations. Why is this true? Because unlike any authors or so-called assassination experts who have speculated about what happened in 1963, she was there during the fateful events following the twin assassinations in Dallas, a true eyewitness to history. This meant Kilgallen had first-hand information about shocking evidence presented at Ruby's trial that completely obliterates long-held bogus theories about his complicity in JFK's death, as indicated by actual trial transcript page excerpts published here for the first time. Why this happened? Why the truth about Kilgallen and her assassinations investigation continues to be hidden from public view leaves behind a trail of those who failed a call to duty, a call to help unravel the mystery of how she died and why. These persons include uncaring family members who refuse to cooperate in a fresh investigation, employing excuses ranging from disinterest to supposedly being scared to come forward. A variety of witnesses who know critical facts surrounding her death but have failed to respond to pleas for assistance. And the New York County District Attorney's Office, which promised a thorough investigation in 2017, but then initiated a double cross that left this author and a stunned public searching for answers. Worse, the latest cover-up pretends of providing safe harbor for the chief suspect in Kilgallen's death, since the failed investigation will, unless new action is taken, set a pathological liar with psychopathic tendencies free, despite mountains of evidence pointing to the suspect's complicity in her death. That the inside story of how the truth has been blunted once more paints a disturbing portrait of how the reputation of a true American patriot, one who gave up her life for her country in the line of duty, was bloodied again some 5 decades and counting after she died. It begins with understanding how Kilgallen overcame a plethora of obstacles to rise to the top of her profession. How the courageous woman of whom famed attorney F. Lee Bailey once said, "She was a very bright and very good reporter of criminal cases, the best there was," became a target of an all-powerful accuse-the-accuser strategy by those threatened with exposure of wrongdoing. When Kilgallen died, was she denied even the basic constitutional rights afforded to an American citizen when serious questions are raised about his or her death? Arguably, her most unforgettable quote was, "Justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too." These powerful words set the stage for examining whether Dorothy May Kilgallen, a woman of the truth, a woman of integrity, has been provided the justice she deserves.